Welcome to E-commerce Made Simple, a podcast created by Adjust Media. Each week, we invite e-commerce entrepreneurs like you to share their stories and backgrounds on how they've achieved success in their e-commerce business and the lessons that they've learned that will make your e-commerce journey as simple as possible. I'm your host, Uri Weinberger.
In this episode, you'll learn why hiring and retaining the right team members is crucial to success, why a frequent release schedule is pivotal to increase your customer lifetime value, and why keeping core products in stock is important to maintaining customer acquisition costs.
Joining us today, we have Adi Ajayi, founder and CEO of Dianu. Dianu sells unique and modern African-inspired clothing for men, women, and children. Founded in 2014 with close to $7 million in annual revenues, we appreciate the time you are taking to explain your starter story.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Uri. I'm glad to be here.
My pleasure, Adi. Thank you for taking the time. Let's just dive right into it. Can you tell us what inspired you to start your business and what that looked like in the early days?
Yes. So I first had the idea to start Dianu back in 2013. At that time, I was working for a lab supply company. I was a buyer for this company, and I was really unhappy with my job at the time. And I was looking for an opportunity to start my own business. So I was really inspired after reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad to start looking for an opportunity. And at that time, I remember speaking to one of my friends. Just to give you a background, I am originally from Nigeria and my family moved to the US when I was 6 years old. So when I was speaking to this other friend of mine who's also Nigerian, she was saying how popular like the prints were becoming. Like we grew up with like bold, like African printed clothing. And in our country, we refer to the fabric as Ankara. So it's like a bold wax printed fabric. And we use it for traditional styles, whether it's for special occasions or even daily wear. And my friend was saying how she thought she saw a dress at the department store Macy's made out of this type of fabric. And that kind of gave me an idea. I'm like, you know, it was really hard to find modern pieces that were ready to wear made with this type of fabric. So I did a bit of research online and I was looking for any leading brand that offered this ready to wear solution. And I couldn't really find a brand online that would offer African-inspired fashion. So I decided to fill that void in the market. At that time, I didn't have a fashion background. I had a business and marketing background. So I had to kind of learn about the business of fashion through reading books, through research online, and I started working towards launching this business. So what really inspired me is like the fact that, you know, it is something that was for me. Like I was interested in looking for modern African inspired fashion, you know, something that I could wear even to work or just for special occasions or just day to day. And there really wasn't anything out there. And at the time, if you were looking for this type of fashion, you had to buy the fabric. You had to look for fabric, buy it. And then you had to look for a tailor and get it made for you. And you let them know like what style you wanted. So that process was not only lengthy, but it was also expensive. So it's something that like people in Africa, like in Nigeria, it's easy to find the fabric and it's easy to find a tailor and it's pretty inexpensive actually. But once you're in like the US or Canada or anywhere in the Western world, it gets pretty expensive to get anything tailor made, as most people already know. So so I set out, you know, I created a business plan and I kind of just figured out like how to source the material, and then I found someone locally in Philadelphia, that's where we're based, to make my initial samples. And initially, I started off with like just clothes for women. And so she made the initial samples. And then I also found a local production and company or factory to sew the garments for me in Philadelphia as well. So that's basically how Dianu came to be. And it started like March 2013 when I started putting together the plans for the business. And then by January 2014, I launched Dianu.com.
Interesting. So how was that process? Like you were looking for a product that was very, very hard to source. And once it was initially, once you overcame that hurdle, you found the sourcing, you found the manufacturing, what did sales look like at the beginning? If you were you selling anything prior to launching the website?
No, I wasn't selling. This was my first endeavor into my own business and also e-commerce. So I initially, because I was more familiar with marketing, so I understood the power of like social media. So prior to launching the website, I started building up like an email list. And then I also had reached out to like other Facebook groups that like feature these types of fashion, or Facebook groups that like they like to highlight products from Africa or things in that nature. So they had, there was this one particular group that had maybe, I want to say like 100,000 like followers. So I reached out to them to have them like promote like an image from my first initial launch. And I was able to, and then lead them to like the website to preemptively sign up before I launched the website. So, so in the beginning, it was a challenge just getting people on the website. And then because I was looking to gather more traction and sell products as quickly as possible, I was also selling on other platforms like Etsy, eBay, Amazon, along with my own website. And at the time when I was still trying to figure out how to drive traffic to the website, most sales came from Etsy and eBay, actually. And I was also doing like in-person like events, vending events, like in Philadelphia, New York. And I was a real hustler, actually. That was actually, at one point, I would set up in front of like a dentist office in Philadelphia, and set up like a clothing rack, a table, and kind of just vent on the sidewalk. And this was after I had quit my full-time job. So I launched Dianu beginning of 2014, January, and then I quit my full-time job by May 2014. And the reason for that was I felt like if I didn't quit, I would always have Dianu as a side business. So I wanted to kind of like, it was kind of like a sink or swim situation where I was like, I want to invest like all my energy into creating this brand and make it work, you know, just figure out a way to make it work. So that gave me time to do these vending events and like and being able to be on the sidewalk in Philly to vend. But I realized that like that was not going to get me very far in scaling. So I knew like my customers could be found online. So I started looking into how to drive traffic to my website online. And it was around October of 2014 when I took this course on Facebook ads marketing. And I was able to start creating ads for Facebook, which transformed my business overnight, or I guess within a couple of weeks, right? Where I was able to drive, you know, relevant traffic to the website of people who were interested in my product. And I was able to grow tremendously like the fourth quarter of my first year in business. And from that year, like the first year, I think the revenue was like around 35,000. And then by year two, after, you know, scaling up a bit on Facebook. We were up to like 500,000 by year two in sales.
Wow, that's huge growth. I do want to make sure that we dive into your paid media later on. But I want to get a sense of when you were, when you first started back to early 2014, Q1 2014, when you reached out to the Facebook group, what was that response immediately? Like you had them promote a picture of the product that you made to their group members. Did that give you the confidence immediately, like driving all those users to the squeeze page where you're getting the email? Was that a successful strategy for you? Did that give you the confidence to eventually say, wow, like, you know, something can come of this? And because you did this prior to quitting your job, right? So,
yeah. I mean, when I was creating the business plan, I was pretty confident in what I was trying to achieve because I'd done a bit of research on like even other Facebook groups that like where they would feature like African-inspired clothing, and oftentimes people weren't sure where to find it. Like it would be like, oh, I got it tailor-made by someone in Nigeria or Ghana. Like my aunt brought it here for me. So people were asking questions of where to find this type of fashion, but there wasn't a readily available website to point them to. So I knew like there was a market for what I wanted to create. And I had a pretty big vision, actually, as I was before I even launched the brand, as far as like where I could see it going. My thought was like creating like the, at the time I thought like the H&M of African inspired fashion, basically just being, having like trendy African inspired fashion that anyone who loves like what's like unique products that's bold, they would be able to get into it and purchase and get into the brand. Yeah.
Wow.
But as far as like reaching out to the group, it was good feedback because I think the image got like over 1,000 likes. And in my mind, you know, I think before you get into e-commerce, like you kind of think like every person who likes, you know, a picture or something, like let's say 20% of those people make the purchase, but we all know it takes more than that. But I was very excited because I'm like, wow, 1,000 people like this product. So that's like 1,000 customers, you know? So it did give me assurance that I was headed in the right direction at least.
Yeah. And I feel as though like back in 2014, likes, comments, like they were more than just a vanity metric like they are today, right? Like,
yeah.
Reach was unbelievable organically,
right?
If it, you know, Facebook groups were still had that organic reach, but they just simply don't anymore,
right?
But yeah, that's great feedback, and it's funny if you would still like have that picture, if you still have it somewhere, like we could throw it into the show notes here, and that, like that's the picture that started it all, right?
Yeah, I have to look for that.
Yeah. Okay. So first year you wrapped up around $35,000 in revenue, and in year two, you almost 20x'd. What did that look like from, like you're saying you have a business background, like what did that look like from an operational perspective, from a cash flow perspective, from, a sourcing perspective? Like how did you meet that demand?
Yeah. So it wasn't too bad. Basically like I just poured all the cash that we're making back into production, into marketing, and you know, the business was scaling on its own. But I guess what made it easier for me at that time was because production took place locally in Philly, and so the timeline was probably not that bad in getting things ready to ship out. Like I think once I got more fabric and I got the fabric cut and sewn, it was like maybe 4 weeks lead time. And then as far as cash flow goes, I would pay after, sometimes I would pay after we already started selling the stuff. So So it was a very great position to be in at that time.
Got it. So you had very favorable terms.
So it was fairly easy to drive growth that way because I wasn't shelling out more cash than was coming in, you know?
Yeah. And with that, like you mentioned earlier that you wanted to be, and I'm air quoting here, the H&M of African fashion. H&M comes out with various designs daily. Like they're really fast fashion. Were you dependent on new designs or did you have staples that were always in throughout that growth period and throughout today, obviously?
Yeah, so in the beginning, we focused on women's fashion and it was, the main driver was actually skirts. Like, so I saw, like when I initially launched, I had 6 styles I launched with and it was like a blouse, 2 dresses, or 3 dresses, a blouse, 3 dresses, and 2 styles of skirts. Actually, a blouse, 2 dresses, and 3 styles of skirts. Yeah. And I noticed right away that the skirts were like the best sellers. It was like a knee-length skirt and like a maxi skirt. So basically for the first, I think, 2 years of the business, our best products were skirts for women. And we just made them in like different styles, different prints. And it was kind of interesting. And that's just what people were interested in the most at that time. And it was a fairly easy product to make and also to fit. Like we didn't have as many fit issues because, yeah, it was just skirts. And as far as what we do now, I mean, now we definitely offer a wider range of products. And as we come out with like new products monthly now, we try to launch like a new collection every month. Like, and the collection could be as small as, you know, 5 products or as large as 30 products, depending on which time of the year. So our larger collections are usually for summer, fall, winter, and then we launch other types of products throughout the year. We, like for instance, next month we have our swim and summer active collection coming out. And after that will be summer. Then we also have like a summer 2 launch. So yeah, we always try and come out with new styles and new items for our customers. And we also keep our staple products. Well, especially now we've learned that it's actually essential to restock like best sellers and really focus in on making sure they're always in stock. We're still working on our inventory, like management and supply chain, to make sure like those items are always in stock and they're always driving sales. Cause I guess in the beginning, I was so focused on always having new styles that I neglected just restocking our old products or our bestsellers from like previous collections. And in my mind, I was like, oh, our customers get sick of this product. But the truth is we didn't have that many customers. So if we're only reaching or converting, like let's say 40,000 customers a year, I mean, there's still like 1 million more customers that could possibly want this product, you know? So it was like kind of better understanding how much life cycle, I guess, goes into a bestseller. Like we can definitely hold on to a product longer and sell it.
And do you feel that over time that you've almost nailed down when you do these seasonal releases, how many units you'd actually have to purchase so you don't overpurchase or underpurchase?
You know, that's always a work in progress because the truth of the matter is we don't always know what the customer will end up loving. Sometimes we feel like we can take a guess, but sometimes it surprises us, to be honest. Like, and it happens time and time again. Even our Black History Month collection that came out in January of this year, we thought like these two dresses would be bestsellers, but then it ended up being our blazers. And in this one print that like we didn't think was the most striking or the most popular, but the blazer ended up being the actual bestseller. And so we try to order like in between, like not, we try not to over order, and then we try not to under order, especially now that we're at a certain size. And then we just keep in mind that if it is a bestseller, we'll just have to work quickly to restock it after it. Yeah. But we don't want to put ourselves in a position where we overstock like a lot of stuff, and it's like it's just taking for our sell through, because that's tying up cash and also taking up space in the warehouse. So we're more, I would rather under order than over order for that reason.
Throughout the years, it seems like you've had some pretty exponential growth. How did you handle that? Like, you go from having, let's say, 6 staple products in 2014, almost 20xing the next year. Now you come out with monthly collections. You have a large catalog of SKUs. What does your team look like? How do you design them? What's the manufacturing process look like? Are you still working with the same manufacturer? How did you handle that scale?
Yeah, so it's been incremental year over year growth. Even though top line, you know, has grown to 7 million, but as far as our in-house team, we have 15 team members. I guess 16, including if I include my brother. My brother Dara, he is our COO/president, and he helps with our operations, which includes like customer service, our warehouse team, and also HR. So we have, we also operate our own warehouse. So we ship our own products from our Philadelphia/Norristown, Pennsylvania location. And we have about 5 people in the warehouse who do a variety of things like pick pack orders. They count inventory, they receive products, and also process like returns and exchanges. And then we have 1 person in customer service. We have 3 people on the design team and 2 people in production. And we also have an HR associate as well, just to help us like with finding new hires and then just managing our current employees as well.
And what did it look like on the manufacturing side? Like, did you stick with the same manufacturer that you originally launched with?
Yeah, so we still work a little bit with our Philadelphia manufacturer just for like easy products. So as we grew, we had to scale and outsource production outside the US. So we currently are producing in Asia, and we're looking to, and we also do some in Africa, in Ghana, and we're looking to expand our Ghana production actually, in Nigeria and Ghana. And yeah, so right now production is no longer just in Philadelphia.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's necessary for a lot of brands. I mean, you've expanded gradually over time, but very exponentially at the same time. Like, so in order, I can imagine that one manufacturer doesn't fit all the needs that are required.
Yeah, exactly.
How is it to manage that production schedule? Are you constantly on it, given that you're launching new SKUs, new collections every month?
Yeah, we're always, production is always going. And it's, you know, we're either monitoring our current inventory to see what we need to replenish, or we're working on new product development. And our design team is also always working, you know, on future collections, and also even revisiting staples to make sure the fit is correct. We have to sometimes refit previous bestsellers to make sure like our customers are happy with the fit. So yeah, it's an ongoing process, production and design.
As you've grown, you went from being the sole founder to managing a team of 16, right? The way that I like to describe it is that founders are oftentimes like an octopus. Like they've got 8 tentacles to do HR, they have to do production, they have to do marketing, they have to do finances. And it seems like you've hired for a lot of these areas of expertise. Where would you say that you, as the founder now, spend most of your time? Like, what is the one area or two areas of focus that you've kept as a responsibility for yourself?
So I still spend a lot of time. I wouldn't say it's almost equal parts with marketing, production, and finance, and then and design as well, because I'm still head of design and marketing, production as well. So I feel like it is kind of like equal parts, like in those four categories, marketing, design, production, finance. Yep.
So let's talk about marketing for a little bit. You mentioned that one of the largest unlocks very early on was Facebook ads.
Right.
Are you still reliant on Facebook ads today? What other paid channels are you using? What other marketing tactics do you see are effective? What's helped you grow over the years?
Yeah, unfortunately, we are still very much reliant on Facebook ads. It is just the best medium for e-commerce at this time, just to drive traffic and sales at a pretty decent price. We also utilize Google, Pinterest. We dabbled in on TikTok, and we will probably still get back into it this year. So those are like our top e or digital marketing platforms at this time. I'm trying to think if there's, of course, we also have the back end of like our email and SMS set up so that we're able to capture people in our sales funnel and convert them later on. And we also have like an affiliate program we run through Pepper Jam, which is now called something else. I can't remember the name of their new company name, but Pepper Jam. And then we also work with like influencers through Grin. We find influencers and they create content for us. But the main drivers are still our digital platforms, which Facebook is primary, Facebook, Instagram, and then followed by Google Ads.
And do you find a large difference of customer acquisition costs between Facebook and Instagram? Like, I would make the assumption that Instagram is more of a driver of acquisition for you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I haven't looked at the data in a while, but I do recall that the last time I checked, Instagram was a lower CPA, I believe, than Facebook. I just remember Instagram was driving a lower, it doesn't drive as much revenue as Facebook, but I believe it had a lower CPA, if I'm not incorrect.
And what type of content do you usually put out there on either organically or via paid?
Yeah, so we create like reels for our audience, just like fun videos, whether it's our models just showcasing the product. And then also because we make products for men and women, we see that a lot of our customers, they do like to match, like they kind of do sets with our products. So we also create content that shows that, like relationship goals.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So relationship goals, people, they just love to see that. And it creates a emotional, you know, feedback from them or response from them that they want to engage with that type of content.
And at what point throughout your journey did you make the decision to launch men's and women's collections?
That started back in 2015, I believe. Towards the end of 2015, we started dabbling in men's clothing. And then from there, we started expanding what we offered for men as well.
And why? Why did you go into men's? Was it, were there requests, or you're just like, wow, this is so successful with women, we should test this out?
Yeah. So, I mean, my thought was always to launch a line for men, women, and kids. If I'm thinking about like how H&M offers those categories as well. And it was just that, like, if women wanted this type of clothing, obviously men also did as well. So it just made sense. And it was just a matter of when and how to do it. And obviously I'm more familiar with women's products. And then it was a learning curve to get into men's products as well. But it was something that I knew that we were eventually going to do.
And at this point, are your customers mostly men? I mean, mostly women, mostly men?
Yeah, so our customer base, based on a survey we did about a month ago, it is mostly women. I think it was a 70-30 break divide, which is interesting because I think when we did a survey back in 2019 or 2018, it was a closer
ratio.
Yeah, thank you for that. It was, I think, 40-60, like 60 women, 40% men. But more recently, we're driving more sales from women, like a lot. It's more apparent that it's women driving the revenue versus men. So I think we need to maybe figure out how to re-engage the male customers at this time.
Could be that the females are buying the sets, the matching sets for the men. They're the ultimate purchase.
Yeah, they are. But I mean, we also, at one point, maybe back before the pandemic, I want to say like 2018, 2019, if you look at like our top 10 best sellers, it would be like 7 of those products were male products. So like we had a lot of male customers shopping for themselves. But for some reason now it's just been flipped where majority of our best sellers are female products, and the females shopping for themselves and of course for their partners as well. So yeah, it was just interesting to see that change over time.
Definitely interesting. And then can you dive deep into your influencer support? So you mentioned that you're using Grin, you're finding influencers. Has that been a successful tactic for you?
I mean, it has been helpful. I mean, as you know, influencer marketing is a toss-up. Like, so many people have gone into it and it's kind of inflated the cost of working with influencers. And sometimes it's hard to track how profitable or how impactful these influencers are. So Grin kind of makes it a bit easier to just manage the relationship with the influencers and also to track their performance. And based on what we're seeing in Grin, like our return is close to like 1.5 ROAS based on like us paying the influencers for content and how much revenue they drive for us, which is pretty low. It's definitely lower than we would like, but it's the good thing about the influencer content is we can also use it on our own platforms and we can also use them in ads. So that's been the added benefit of using our influencers.
And when you're deciding to to dedicate your time, your effort, your resources into a particular channel, whether that's email, Google ads, Facebook ads, influencers. What is the ultimate goal for you? What metric do you look at and say, okay, this is working or this is not working? Is it customer acquisition cost? Is it ROAS? Is it retention?
Yeah, I mean, I still look at ROAS. And I know some people say that may not be the most important metric, but for us, it certainly is still the most important. I mean, if I'm seeing at least, I want to say like 3.5 and up ROAS, then that's a pretty good channel for us. I mean, we need to see at least a 4X across all our blended ROAS, across all our platforms to have a great like day in sales and be at a profitable level that we would like to maintain. So any platform that's able to drive at least a 3.5 and above is a pretty good channel for us.
And do you guys work, I mean, most of these channels, whether it's being in paid media or influencers, are mostly driven by prospecting and customer acquisition. What are you doing on the retention side that is successful for you and you think that you are doing a great job and what sets you apart?
Yeah, so as far as retention goes, well, first of all, you have to make sure you have great products that customers love and they would come back to buy more. So we always pay attention to quality of our products. And then we also have our sales funnel set up where we have our customers like email and phone number for SMS marketing. So that's those two channels have been great ways to retarget our customers to the point where our repeat customer rate is, I think it's at 50% for year to date, which is pretty significant. So that means that we're able to really drive, it's actually 44%. So that means we're able to really drive repeat purchases from our customers. And I think a lot of it is because we just have that, our sales funnel set up with SMS, email, and also retargeting on Facebook, Instagram, and Google, also YouTube as well. We retarget on YouTube and Pinterest.
You're firing on all cylinders.
We are trying.
I think that the release schedule probably has a lot to do with that, right? Like with monthly releases, it just keeps on enticing and giving the customer a reason to come back and purchase again.
Yeah, definitely. And which is exactly why we do that, so that they are always able to find something new they love and buy again.
Do you stick with a fairly consistent annual release schedule, or are you planning it quarterly? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, it has more or less been the same for the last 3-4 years. I mean, we tweak it here and there in terms of when we launch. Like, it might be the same month and we launch in a different, like, earlier in the month or later in the month. And then also what we're launching has shifted a bit. For instance, this will be the first year we're launching Swim and Summer Active this early. We normally launch, we're usually behind on Swim for whatever reason, but this year we decided to bring it up front before we even launched our summer collection. So we tweak like what products get launched. And even this year, we're planning to launch a bag line in August. And that will be the first time we ever launched a collection of bags, like just by itself. So we'll see. We're playing with some things and seeing what works better.
Yeah, I mean, if your SKU of your customer base is 70-30 female to male, that bag launch will probably sell out fairly quickly.
Yeah, well, we're actually launching backpacks as well. So it'll be for everyone, the collection will be for anyone, actually.
Is there a process that goes behind the product development in the sense that customers are involved, or as the lead designer, you say like, okay, these have been historically really well-performing prints and designs, which will just translate into bags?
I usually am the one driving what products. And then, of course, like, we work to analyze previous sales to see like which prints are doing well. And that was one of the questions we asked, like, which prints would do well in a backpack that has been a bestseller for us. And those are the prints that we are using for the bags. And sometimes when we're not sure about either a design element or a print, we will ask our audience. We have a Facebook VIP group for Dianu customers, and that has about, I think, 12,000 members at this point. And yeah, so we'll ask them like, which prints do you like? We did it for the backpacks actually, and they helped us like narrow down our prints. And then sometimes some styles, like we have a question about, like we'll ask our audience what they prefer, and it kind of guides our decision.
So the community does provide you with significant feedback that goes into product development.
Yeah, they definitely provide us with feedback, correct.
What's been your biggest challenge to date? Because it seems as though, you know, you've been extremely successful at what you've done over the years. It's been incremental, but you've grown considerably. And a lot of our listeners, a lot of the founders, wish they could achieve the success that you have. But it's not all rainbows and butterflies, right? So what's been your biggest challenge over the years?
Yeah, so I would say one of the biggest challenges is just finding the right people, the right team members to help manage different parts of the business. As you mentioned, you know, a founder is usually wearing many hats, and I was definitely doing a lot in the earlier days. There was just a lot to do all the time. And as we grew, we needed team members to manage certain parts of the business. And I would say, thankfully, at this point, we are in a pretty good place where we have some solid team members that are handling, let's say, you know, the website marketing and our design team, even production team member, our warehouse team. So I say we're very lucky and blessed with our current team members. And yeah, like I just think retaining and hiring the right people is obviously such a critical part of running a successful business, because there's only so much one person, the founder or even the second person, can do. And as you grow, you need people you can rely on to come through. And sometimes it's just hard finding the right person, you know? So I will say that's one of the biggest challenge. And then the second biggest challenge we ran into was with marketing. As I already mentioned, Facebook, Instagram are our two biggest digital marketing platforms. And back in 2021, when the whole iOS 14 update went through, and it kind of threw everything out of whack for our Facebook ads. That was back in June 2021. Yep. And it was pretty dramatic, like the difference it made in our top line and bottom line, because we were not profitable for the first time ever in 2021 because of that change, just that change. And if you know, the Facebook algorithm wasn't performing like it used to, and we were driving less revenue and sales from our main, and less traffic too, because if you're driving less traffic, that also impacts the other channels. It impacted like the entire sales funnel, so we weren't getting as many new customer emails, as phone numbers, and even it impacted Google's performance. So that was a really big challenge for us, just overcoming that and getting to a place where we could be profitable and growing again.
And were you able to navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, last year was still dicey. But we managed to we had to cut some expenses, and we had to be more laser focused on how we were spending money and make sure that we were getting, you know, the best return we could. But Facebook was still okay. And it wasn't towards like Q4 of 2022 that things started performing better for us. And it was as a result of, two things. We had the launching or the release of Black Panther 2 that came out in November. So leading up to that, like, sales spiked up. And then we also have like our sweaters, which are high performance for us because it's so unique. There's no other brand making like African inspired sweaters. So those products really helped boost our sales for Q4, which helped us ultimately be profitable for the year.
And what defines success for you in 2023?
So in 2023, we've had a great start to the year, and we're looking forward to continuing that growth. And one of the initiatives we're doing is we are opening up a warehouse, or we're working with a 3PL in Canada to ship and serve the Canadian market. It is our second biggest market, and we haven't actively marketed to Canada before, and it's because of all the barriers to the customers purchasing, where they have to pay high cost of shipping and custom and duty taxes, and ends up costing a lot, you know, just to order a couple of items from us. So we realized that, you know, the market has a lot of potential, but we wanted to remove those barriers and sell directly. So we're looking forward to making that live by April 3rd, and hopefully adding, you know, an additional million to our top line revenue with this initiative. And then we're also working to improve our inventory management in regards to our staple products, making sure they are really indeed always in stock, and then we're able to promote them on Facebook, Instagram all the time. So we don't always have to turn off ads because the item is sold out, is low inventory, as we currently have to do. Those two things I think will help us a lot this year as we're aiming to reach top line revenue of 10 million.
Wow, that would be phenomenal.
Yeah, we're definitely excited about the goal, and we believe it's definitely attainable if we can just get our inventory management and get that together.
Well, Adi, I wish you luck on that. I'm sure you'll be able to achieve it. I also want to take this time to thank you for sharing your story with me, with our listeners. It's truly inspirational. As we wrap up this podcast, I'd just like to open the floor to you and for you to let us know, where can our listeners find you? Where can they find products?
Yeah, so our website is dianu.com. That's DIYANU.com. And then you can also find us with that same brand name on Instagram, Facebook. And I can be reached on LinkedIn at Adi Ajayi, And that's Addy, A-D-D-I-E, and Ajayi, A-J-A-Y-I.
Perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time, Addy.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
This wraps up another episode of E-Commerce Made Simple. Each week, we find e-commerce entrepreneurs who are willing to share their successes, challenges, and stories so business owners like you can learn valuable lessons that will make your e-commerce journey as simple as possible. If you like what you heard today and would like to connect with either myself or the guests that we had on today's show, join our exclusive free Facebook community. Head on over to www.facebook.com/groups/ecommercemadesimple or simply hit the link in the show notes below. I'll catch you in the next episode.